give you a warm welcome on behalf of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration of the United States, on behalf of the Australian Government through its Department of Supply, and on behalf of Spacetrack Proprietary Limited to Deep Space Instrumentation Facility 42. Today's ceremony marks a great step forward in a partnership, albeit ours is a junior partnership, in space research. It is an exercise which will go to enriching the world's technology, and out of this there is a little fallout for us in Australia. It is a project which develops great international understanding and friendships at a time when the world stands sorely in need of both of these things. And gentlemen, it's a partnership which means a good deal to Australia in terms of the availability of modern technology. Because in this project, the key is that technicians associated with the station shall go to the United States and there to receive their technical training. The United States has freely made available to us in Australia the use of all NASA equipment when not required on their own projects. And this is a service which has been used quite extensively by our own departments and on occasion by our universities. We have full access to the results of this space research. And of course, the fact that weather satellites are today taking over much of the task of meteorology, the fact that the output of the United States weather satellites is available to Australia means that we've been able to upgrade considerably our meteorological service. All of these are byproducts of space development. All of these are avenues through which the generosity of the United States has been clearly shown. And in this, I'm bound to say, the United States is not a misunderstood friend in Australia. Of course, there is very great virtue in getting to know each other in the scientific and technical, as well as in the political and social field. And if it weren't for activities of this kind, how else would the United States and the more forward-looking technical world know about Tidbin Billa? But in fact, the United States not only knows it's here, but they can tell you within 50 yards, plus or minus inches, exactly where Tidbin Billa is. And we value the personal associations that come out of the space project. I recall a little while ago when we had the pleasure of a visit from the United States Congressional Committee on Science and Astronautics. To the best of my knowledge, this is the first time that we have had a visit from a full committee of this kind. And of course, after the manner of politicians visiting abroad, they were out to see whether there was any gold plating going on in the overseas organization paid for by the taxpayer. And I happened to be a very interested spectator to that final moment when they really found some gold plating. Because as we walk through the halls, to which you will be admitted shortly, there is some highly complex technical equipment which needs to be gold plated. Well, this started a file, as you can imagine, and finally the file for explanation came down to my good friend Dr. Recton, whose scientific home is the Jet Propulsion Laboratories, and this worthy gentleman, with his mind more on science than on the devious ways of politicians, wrote an answer to this and said, yes, it's gold-plated, but underneath we silver-plate it first. But what this does, gentlemen, is tell us something of the extraordinary complexity and the astounding demands of modern techniques which go into the space age. And some of this, as I say, you'll be glad to see for yourself quite shortly. I had rather hoped that we would have some members of the committee here with us today, but unfortunately they're heavily engaged before the Congress in arguing for their budget. And their budget, I may say, looks like $5.3 billion for the coming year. Well, history repeats itself in this because it's 500 years, give or take a year, since Christopher Columbus thought to finance an expedition into what new worlds he might find, even at the expense of Queen Isabella's jewels. These days, of course, there is the same kind of procession, slightly elaborated, because the scientists of today must go to the Treasury looking for money. It's a little more expensive because, as I understand it, there has been some inflation in the last 500 years. Anyhow, things seem to cost a good deal more. But then, as now, there were people who questioned the reason for this kind of activity. And just as Columbus was questioned, so are the space scientists today, asked to justify their work. All I know is that on every hand there is evidence that in engineering, in transport, in communications, in every aspect of business and industry today, there is evidence of the fallout into everyday life of the scientific principles which have been discovered and refined because of space developments. In our Department of Supply, we seek to enrich Australian industry for defence and for all other purposes by giving them access to modern technology. And so the station which you see before you, as well as others in the space network, are operated by contract. And I therefore happy to acknowledge today the implications in this program of Space Track Proprietary Limited, a company formed of Hawker de Havilland, Australian Electrical Industries, and Elliott Automation, three great names in modern industrial practice here in Australia. And between them, they've provided much of the amenities you see here, they've superintended its erection, they've paid every attention to the comfort of the staff and to the efficiency of the operation of this undertaking. But if a word of thanks is due, I should also like to address those words to the landowners in this area of the Australian Capital Territory, because this is only one of a complex of three tracking stations presently being built in this section of the Australian Capital Territory. It's a project in which we've had the cooperation of the landowners, even at some sense of loss and inconvenience to them. We appreciate this very much. We're appreciative to the contractors who have done so much to get the station built on time, so faithfully, and into operation. I would express a word of thanks to the officers of my own department who've worked long and hard and harmoniously with our United States principles. This is a great occasion when we're called upon to dedicate this facility to the advance of science, to the growth of human knowledge, and to the safety of those courageous people who will venture into a hostile environment in space. Happily, today's event has been noted at headquarters. Our own, because I'm delighted to acknowledge the presence with us today of the Right Honourable the Prime Minister, who gives in this way his blessing to a great undertaking in partnership. I'll have the pleasure of introducing him in a moment. But in the meantime, the episode has been noted at that other headquarters in the White House. For today, we have a message from the President of the United States, addressed to the Right Honourable the Prime Minister, but I'm going to presume on the Prime Minister for the first time and ask that the Chargé d'Affaires of the United States Embassy should make this message public. Mr. Lydman will read the President's address, and in the terminology of modern commercial television, there will be a pause for this message from our sponsor. Mr. Lydman.
Thank you. From President Johnson to the Prime Minister, and I quote, "It is a great pleasure for me to congratulate you on the outstanding and continuing contribution Australia is making to progress in the space age. The standard of performance at the tracking and data acquisition facilities already existing in Australia is excellent. I am confident that at the new space tracking facility at Tidbinbilla, we will see the same high level of performance. The station, which is operated entirely by Australians, is now tracking the Mariner satellite on its photographic mission to Mars. Today, in dedicating this facility, we take another step forward in the close cooperation between our two countries and in the effort of all those around the world who seek to labor together, to share their talents, to assure greater mutual understanding. This will be the true measure of our success in the exploration of outer space. And it is for this special reason, Mr. Prime Minister, that I extend my deep appreciation and best wishes for the operation of this new station." Sir.
Your Excellencies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to introduce at this time the Prime Minister of the Commonwealth of Australia, the Right Honourable Sir Robert Menzies.
Sir, Your Excellencies, and ladies and gentlemen, yes. You may imagine that my presence here calls for some explanation, and I concede that point. Now, I'm here for two reasons. One is that being Alan Fairhall's Prime Minister, he wasn't game not to ask me. Now, that's one very good reason. The other very good reason is that he knew that I would bring to this task a completely fresh and untrammeled mind, untrammeled by the faintest scientific knowledge. I live in the Dark Ages, in this sense. I drive in here this morning and I see this great dish-looking object sticking up. And in some vague way, I know that it has something to do with collecting information from outside. But how it's done, I haven't the faintest idea. Well, this, of course, is unpardonable ignorance, I know. I can see Sir Frederick White gazing at me with great contempt. But it does give me an objective, clear mind. I come to this problem without any prejudices whatever. And therefore, coming to it without prejudice, I just want to say that I think that this is a very remarkable example of two things. The first is the rapid progress that does go on in this scientific and technological age. I know that every now and then something will crop up in Cabinet, and my colleague here will be putting up a proposal of some kind, and in our ignorance we may question it and want to know what the end result is and whether the end result is really worth all that money. And he is constant to tell us, and it's so true, that it's not so much the end result always as the information you gather as you go, the improvement in techniques, the stretching out of the borders of our own technological knowledge. And this is profoundly true. We perhaps direct too much attention to some distant end result and too little to the fact that in this century, and increasingly in this century, the country that is backward in these fields, it will be backward in 100 ways that may not appear to be closely connected with what's going on. And therefore, this is a great step forward, a notable event in this technological period of our lives. And in the second place, it's one more example of the kind of cooperation that is extended by the United States to its friends. Not always, perhaps, to its friends, but in double measure to its friends. I looked through the papers that were sent to me to find out something about the budgetary aspects of these tracking stations, and I'm bound to tell you, Mr. Lydman, that though you mustn't use this against me in future, that I thought it was a bit one-sided. You seem to be carrying the enormous bulk of the expenditure. Well, this is, if I may say so, characteristic of your great country. We ourselves have been capable of producing great resources in what may be called scientific manpower. And this station is manned, as I gather, by Australians. This is of great advantage to us because it increases the stock of knowledge in these fields in Australia. It's also of advantage to the United States because in suitable areas it is able to get highly skilled and authentic information in the course of tracking satellites or other objects moving around in space. There's a certain mutuality about this, but behind it all is a tremendous friendship. Every time I'm told that some reports go in from one of the tracking stations in Australia, there will be a friendly and generous compliment passed from the United States end on the skill with which the operation has been conducted. Sometimes people think that a little country like Australia, little in terms of numbers, maintains a very close friendship with the United States purely for purposes of self-interest. Now, of course, I'm not going to deny for one moment that we have a tremendous, lively interest in Australia, in the friendship and goodwill of the United States. But in the same way, there's a mutuality about this, because all great powers, and history has demonstrated this, inspire, on the whole, rather more enmities than friendships, jealousies, resistances. And they need friends. And even though Australia is a relatively small country, I know from my contacts there that there's a genuine feeling that the attitude of Australia on these matters is one of immense satisfaction to the American administration and the American people. Big friends, little friends, but friends. And friends on this occasion cooperating in one of the new miracles of the 20th century. Sir, that's all I want to say. I noticed that you discreetly placed around through the audience little cartons or tins or something of fly repellents. They sprayed me a bit on the way out, and I'm bound to say so far I haven't been struck by a fly, and I don't think you have either. And therefore, the event is happier still, and adding all these things together, I have the greatest pleasure in the world in declaring it open.
Prime Minister, Your Excellencies, gentlemen, it's a great pleasure at this stage to introduce Mr. Ed Buckley, Senior Representative of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, who is at the same time Director of Data Acquisition and Tracking. Gentlemen, Mr. Ed Buckley.
Mr. Prime Minister, Minister Fairhall, distinguished guests, 7 years ago we put up the first satellite, and one of the first two we put up was a small grapefruit-sized vehicle. We suddenly began to realize we'd put a star in the sky that was going to stay up there 2,000 years. And a few of us were a bit shaken by the fact that we had suddenly added to a star in the sky. Well, we can look back now after 7 years and see what we've done. Let me say that the scientific payoff from the work we're doing seems to take 4 or 5 years before you really see it. And in the last several months, well, I think there's been some interesting results in the United States that gives you appreciation of the scope of what we're doing. Studying the path of these vehicles as they go around the Earth and the imperfections or peculiarities in those paths has given us some knowledge of the inside of the Earth. This is surprising, but we get some information. We have advanced the theories of what the inside of the Earth is like, of what the stress in the crust of the Earth is. We have come up with calculations that indicate that there is concentrations of high density mass in various places in the Earth, one of the places incidentally being in Southeast Asia. These affect the paths of the vehicles going around the Earth. Of course, you add instruments to these vehicles and you're suddenly studying the atmosphere in which we live. You're finding out things that we hadn't known about it before, leading you, as I'll mention a little bit later, to better knowledge of the weather. And you study the upper atmosphere. You find out we actually have come up with better knowledge of what constitutes the upper atmosphere, that there's a strata of helium in the upper atmosphere that we had never known before. We realize now that what the upper atmosphere is determined largely by a very tiny part of the radiation that comes from the sun. The ultraviolet radiation is absorbed in the upper atmosphere, and this determines the structure of that area and the temperature of that area. We found a tide in the atmosphere that follows the sun around, a bump on the atmosphere that follows the sun around the Earth. We've studied the ionosphere. Before, our studies of the ionosphere were limited to what we could see from the bottom, and because the signals weren't penetrating the ionosphere, why, we didn't know very much about the upper half of it. So our satellites have carried equipment that study the ionosphere from the top side. As a result of this, we have come up with some new theories about the ionosphere, what it is, why it's there, and it's very possible that from this knowledge, there'll be improvement in long-distance radio communication. As you go on out from this, you study, of course, the moon next. This station and another station of WOMER are particularly important in that. You've seen the pictures we get on the moon, but we want to go farther. We're going to land vehicles on the moon and see what it's made of. Besides green cheese, we all know that. We again, by putting a vehicle in orbit around the moon, not only will take pictures, but very probably we can calculate what's inside the moon, just as we have done with the Earth. And from this, perhaps we can find out how the moon was formed. As you go on out to the planets, we know very little about the planets. They've been a great mystery. We've already sent a vehicle out there. The Early Mariner went out and measured the temperature of the surface of Venus, for instance. We're going out, the vehicle on the way to Mars now, which is halfway there. It will take pictures and send them back by television at a time when Mars is 135 million miles from the Earth. And finally, of course, we've been studying the radiation from the sun. And this affects our lives all the time. It affects the atmosphere and the ionosphere, as I mentioned. And when you get through, you realize we've been living in a greenhouse here, a protected shell. The atmosphere and the elements above us here are sort of a protective shell around us. Only a small part of the radiations of the sun gets through to us. Some of it is changed, some of it is absorbed. So this then gives us an idea of what caused the environment we live in, its temperature and the constituents of the atmosphere and so forth. As you see, once we learn how this came about on the Earth, probably we can begin to anticipate what we're going to find on the planets a little better, because they are subjected to some of the same bombardment from the sun, the solar radiation and fluxes. And so perhaps we can anticipate by some scientific theory and calculations what we're going to find when we get to Mars or Venus, or we certainly can extend and interpret the data that we get from those. A small amount of data will be extended and supplemented by the theories that we'll have. And one interesting result, incidentally, very recently, is that we've been anticipating meteorites out in space. But we suddenly seem to have found that the meteorites are all near the Earth. The vehicles leaving here run through a stream of meteorites, and then the number of meteorites decrease. Now, actually, I'm talking from some very early results. I hope that they confirm it now that I've mentioned it. This particular station here, of course, is going to be for the exploration of the moon and the planets, and I don't think in our program there's a more exciting part of the program. This is going to capture everyone's imagination, I'm sure, as the pictures we took of the moon already have, but as soon as we get some pictures of Mars, I'm sure that this is going to be great interest in many articles in the newspaper about it. I'd like to mention very quickly what we call the application satellites. There's the weather satellite that was mentioned earlier. The weather is we really have very small number of measurements around the Earth telling what the weather is going to be. Because the Earth is covered to a great extent by water, that we get relatively few measurements. So we're hoping that the meteorological satellites, as they're extended, are going to tell us a lot, give us a lot of additional information that allow us to predict the weather. Certainly, the infrared-seeking devices, the temperature-seeking measuring devices that are aboard these meteorological satellites, will tell us the temperature of the Earth and the heat exchange between the sky and the Earth as it goes around and around the Earth. And from this, we will begin to be able to anticipate with computing machines what the weather is going to be. We have established communication satellites, and you might be interested to know that the SINCOM 2 and SINCOM 3, the last two which are in synchronous orbit, are in 24-hour service handling military communications into Southeast Asia. One of those vehicles, by the way, stands perfectly still in the sky, so still that you can point antennas at it in the evening and then shut them off and come in the next morning and turn them on, and they're still pointed right at it. In other words, the vehicle is absolutely standing still. It isn't moving across the sky whatsoever. You've heard a brief mention of our geodetic satellite work, which means that we're going to have better mapping and better knowledge of the coordinates of the various places on Earth. And finally, recently announced, although we've been working on it for several years, but they've just announced the success of it, is the navigation satellite, which will allow ships at sea to come up with a new method of finding out exactly where they are. They are far more accurate than the traditional old celestial navigation devices. I get asked, and I have some down here in the last day or so, what are the benefits? Well, there's the scientific benefits, which I've been mentioning, and I guess some of these application satellites speak for themselves, the benefits. But you want to know, what are you really after on this? What are the benefits? Well, I'm going to mention a few, and then I'm going to come back with a sort of a summary on it, because this is a question that is hard to answer in the United States, too. We've learned how to make things more reliable, how to put effort in that makes them work and work for a long period. Our satellites that were up as little as 2 years ago only had a life of, say, 2 months, possibly 3 months. Now the vehicles seem to have, the ones right after that, are still working. Some have been up 2 or 3 years, and we think that they're going to keep working many years. In fact, we're beginning to worry now about how to shut some of them up. There's an international body that's requesting some attention from us on that problem. Of course, as quickly as we got this reliability improved, all of a sudden the communication satellites, which had been sort of hanging fire, suddenly became practical. And the stock of the Communication Satellite Corporation reacted to that in the United States pretty markedly. It jumped tremendously as a result of this increase in reliability, which suddenly made the communication satellites practical. Such a nary as computers has received a big impetus from the space program because of the fact that we're an extensive user. We have to have them for practically every phase of our work. And this has acted as a primer to the computer industry. They have built better computers, improved their techniques, their manufacturing ability. And so this is a typical area that's been improved. One interesting benefit from the space program, I think, is energy sources. You know that these vehicles that go up generate their electricity from little solar cells that are attached to them. We've improved the batteries that are in them. We've just come up with converting chemical energy to electrical energy directly, a device called fuel cells. And you'll see those, I'll bet, on your stations here in, not the tracking stations, but your ranches in Australia within 10 years, I'm sure. When you look at the small benefits which people keep asking, they're kind of hard to find. We learned how to do better soldering, we learned how to make better transistors, but as you look at the small details, all of a sudden you decide that this isn't where the benefits from the space program really is. It's where an earlier speaker mentioned, the whole technology has been speeded up, and you suddenly sense that everything seems to have been speeded up as a result of the effort going into space. Well, there's another benefit, and that is the international cooperation is going on, and they are the friends we've made in other countries. There is no equivalent installation. Australia has more dishes and equipment, more facilities, space facilities than any other country except the United States itself. There's no other country that has the equivalent amount. Well, I think that I want to thank Minister Fairhall for his appreciation and farsightedness that resulted in the operational contracts with which our stations in Australia are going to be operated. These contracts are with the Australian industry. And so far, we're most pleased with the quality of the results. We have already seen it up in Carnarvon, the northwest corner, and here the results are already very evident here at this station. I would like to thank the Prime Minister in the name of the government of the United States. We certainly couldn't carry on the space program with the existing scope or quality without the help of the government of Australia. I sincerely hope that there has been and will be proportional benefits here in Australia from the effort. Now, Mr. Prime Minister, as a small token of our appreciation, I'd like to present you with a model of the facility here. It's 1/100th scale. It doesn't operate, but on the other hand, it's a pretty exact model, very carefully made.
You wouldn't care to throw in a small textbook, would you?
Well, as a matter of fact, yeah, there was some added descriptions there with it, and I took pity on you a little bit and tried to tone them down so that they didn't have some of these foul wording.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Prime Minister, Your Excellencies and Gentlemen, around the world today there is a network of deep space instrumentation facilities all waiting at this time to welcome DSIF 42 as a new addition to the network. There are some messages of greetings which we will now hear.
Of the deep space instrumentation facility, why Jansen, South Africa. Space pleasure in welcoming your station into the deep space strapping fraternity and extending to you their best wishes for a successful future. May your major remain constantly at 4 degrees Kelvin and your receiver stay in love from horizon to horizon. Hollis von Vesta.
This is Walt Larkin, manager of the Goldstone Space Communication Station, welcoming our cobblers down in Pittman Villa, DSIF. Into the net. So welcome to the net. I'm sure we'll be seeing each other quite often, both in person and while we're talking over the hotlines the net has. And we'll be looking forward to good data coming from that station in the near future. Again, welcome, and we'll be seeing you on the hotline.
This message from John Hazlow, Acting Station Manager of DSIF 41, is to Bob Leslie, the Station Director of DSIF 42. I am very pleased to know that your station is now officially operational, and on behalf of every one of us here, I extend a warm welcome into the Deep Space Network. Of all the stations in the net, it is our special privilege to greet a sister station and to look forward to our mutual cooperation.
Your Excellencies and Gentlemen, at this moment I propose to remedy that minor deficiency to which the Prime Minister referred. I propose to ask him to join me in an inspection of the station, during which I'm sure he will learn a good deal about the scientific background of space developments. Meantime, however, I would be grateful if honoured guests would remain seated for a few moments, because the manager of Spacetrack Proprietary Limited, Mr. Galbraith, will have a few words which I'm sure will facilitate your own inspection and movement about the base. Gentlemen, that concludes our official opening ceremony. Thank you.